Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger and the Mason City Globe Gazette for Thursday, November 16th. I'm your reader, Mark John Conley. Now let's get started with some Fort Dodge news. Our first headline today reads, Buckle Up for Safety. Iowa State Patrol focusing on seatbelt enforcement over Thanksgiving holiday. So far in 2023, there have been 325 fatalities on Iowa roads, the highest number by November 15th over the last 6 years, according to data collected by the Iowa Department of Transportation. With the Thanksgiving holiday coming up next week and the influx of additional traffic that comes with major holidays, the Iowa State Patrol aims to keep travelers safe on the road. "We'll be pushing a heavy focus on seatbelt enforcement," said Iowa State Patrol Trooper Paul Gardner, Public Information Officer for ISP District 7. Thanksgiving last year, there were 7 fatalities statewide, which was the deadliest in 10 years, he said. Though Iowa has had a primary safety belt law since 1986, allowing law enforcement to stop a motorist if they are observed not wearing a seatbelt, there are still many drivers and passengers who don't buckle up. According to Gardner, in 2023, troopers in ISP District 7 have written 729 seatbelt citations, compared to 550 last year. District 7 covers Calhoun, Hamilton, Humboldt, Kossuth, Pocahontas, Webster, and Wright counties. "Wearing a seatbelt isn't just the law," Gardner said, "but it saves lives." Of the 325 traffic fatalities this year, 47% were not wearing a seatbelt. While a seatbelt won't prevent a crash from happening, it greatly increases the chances of survival, Gardner said. The Iowa State Patrol has a seatbelt convincer device that simulates a 10-mile-per-hour crash, so the rider can feel just how important wearing a seatbelt is. Gardner has taken it to various community events, including the Webster County Fair and the Iowa State Fair. Gardner also noted that it's important for young children and infants to be properly buckled in as well. Iowa law requires infants under 1 year old and weighing less than 20 pounds to be secured in a rear-facing car seat. Children between 1 and 5 years old must be in a car seat or a booster seat, and older children up to 18 years old must wear a seatbelt. The law doesn't currently require adults over 18 to wear seatbelts in the back seat of a vehicle, Gardner said, but all vehicle passengers are encouraged to buckle up for safety. If you have somebody in the back seat, if you're the driver and your buddy who's behind you is not buckled in, he's going to be thrust forward and crush you between the seat and the steering wheel, he said. A lot of serious injuries accompany that. When somebody's not buckling up, they think I'd only hurt myself. But in reality, you become a 200-pound missile if you're not buckled in, he said. Our next local news headline for Fort Dodge reads, Fort Dodge prepares for Trump visit, former president coming Saturday. Fort Dodge City and school officials are preparing for a Saturday campaign appearance by former President Donald Trump. Trump, who is again seeking the Republican nomination for president, is scheduled to speak at 3 p.m. Saturday at Fort Dodge Senior High School, located at 819 North 25th Street. Josh Porter, superintendent of the Fort Dodge Community School District, said the Trump campaign contacted the district about 2 weeks ago regarding potential use of the school. He said the facility was, quote, open and available, so it was rented to the campaign. He said school facilities can be used by candidates of any party if they are available. "We are a school. We stay unbiased," he said. "We open up the doors for anyone." Secret Service agents, he said, have already been checking out the school. "They work with schools a lot, so this is not unfamiliar," Porter said. Fort Dodge Regional Airport will remain open even if Trump flies in and out of it on Saturday, according to Rhonda Chambers, the airport's director of aviation. She said the United Express flight schedule will not be impacted. Regarding the former president's visit, Chambers said, "We'll do what we do for any private corporate aircraft. We work with anybody who wants to come in and use this beautiful facility." She acknowledged that the Secret Service has visited the airport this week. City Manager Dave Fierke said a visit by a president or former president demands a higher level of service from local agencies than a visit by other presidential candidates. "We will have additional officers working alongside multiple law enforcement agencies to ensure a safe and successful event for all in attendance," Police Chief Dennis Quinn said. Tickets will be required to attend Saturday's visit by former President Donald Trump. People can sign up for tickets by going to event.donaldjtrump.com. Tickets are free but issued on a first-come, first-served basis. Our next headline reads, "How Webster County Voted on Jail Bond Referendum." Just over a week ago, five Iowa counties had similar countywide public measures on their ballots for the November 7th city school election, asking voters to approve general obligation bonds to fund the construction or renovation of county jail and law enforcement facilities. All but one of these bond issues passed. Webster County's public measure asked voters whether the county government should take out $45.5 million in general obligation bonds to construct a new facility for the Webster County Jail and Webster County Sheriff's Office. The new jail proposal aimed to solve several problems that have arisen over the last several decades with the existing jail, including overcrowding, safety concerns, aging equipment and facilities, and the rising cost of housing overflow inmates in other county jails. The proposal was for a 60,692-square-foot facility that would house both the jail and the sheriff's office. The jail would have 61 general population cells, double bunked, and 8 special needs cells with one bunk, totaling 130 beds. The facility would also include space for jail administration, sheriff's office administration, patrol, investigations, and civil processing. The $45.5 million price tag included the cost of buying the 15 acres needed for the project, as well as the cost of construction. However, the measure failed to receive the 60% of yes votes it needed to pass, falling short by just 266 votes. The measure received 2,835 yes votes, or 54.86%, and 2,333 no votes, or 45.14%. Of the 18 precincts and absentee early voting block, the jail bond received more yes votes in all but five: Fort Dodge 6, Fort Dodge 9, Burnside, Elkhorn, Otho, Pleasant Valley, Sumner, Clayton, Fulton, Johnson, Roland, and Colfax, Hardin, Washington, Webster, Yell. Those precincts covered nearly the entire southern half of the county, except for Gowrie and Dayton's precincts, as well as much of Fort Dodge's south side. Webster County saw a roughly 21% turnout of registered voters on November 7th. In total, 5,168 of those registered voters cast their ballots either on election day or through absentee voting. Similar public measures on the ballots in Greene, Osceola, Page, and Pocahontas counties easily passed on November 7th. Our next headline reads, "Refrigerant leak hits Fort Dodge store." A pipe carrying refrigerant in a Fort Dodge grocery store ruptured Wednesday morning, prompting a response by city police and firefighters. The problem was reported at 9:35 a.m. at Aldi at 1st Avenue South and 29th Street, and was initially described as a freezer explosion. What actually happened, according to Fire Department Captain Jeff Hill, was that a copper pipe carrying refrigerant burst. He said there was probably a loud noise when the pipe burst and some insulation fell to the floor. That, he said, may have caused people to think there had been an explosion. When police and firefighters arrived, there was a light haze in the building, according to Hill. Firefighters checked the quality of the air and used large fans to ventilate the building. Hill said the amount of refrigerant that was found was not toxic. Emergency personnel were on the scene for about an hour. And now, as we have no updates to state news, we'll move to national news headlines. This one reads, Senator Joe Manchin says Donald Trump would destroy U.S. democracy if wins second term as president. And the dateline is Charleston, West Virginia. West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, days removed from announcing he won't seek re-election, said Wednesday that if the nation's voters give former President Donald Trump another term in the White House, he will, quote, destroy democracy in America. Manchin, whose home state voters overwhelmingly backed Trump in the last two presidential elections, made the comment on a press call with West Virginia-based reporters amid speculation that Manchin himself might be weighing a third-party run for president. The moderate West Virginia Democrat said Wednesday that he would never want to be, quote, a spoiler who contributed to getting any other candidate elected. But he said he would do what he had to do in order to save the country. Manchin had harsh words for how the two-party system is currently functioning. But Manchin reserved his harshest comments for Trump, who won every one of West Virginia's 55 counties in both 2016 and 2020, making it one of the former president's most loyal states. Manchin said it would be, quote, dangerous to give Trump another term. Manchin also critiqued Democratic President Joe Biden on Wednesday, saying he has been pushed too far to the left during his term in office. After Manchin announced his decision last week not to seek another term, Trump took to social media to take credit for nudging him out of the race by endorsing the current West Virginia governor's bid for Manchin's Senate seat next year. Manchin's condemnation of Trump came less than a week after the senator, who was a state lawmaker, secretary of state, and governor of once deep blue West Virginia before being elected to the Senate in 2010, announced he would not pursue another term because of his frustration with the political divide in U.S. politics. Manchin would have had a difficult path to re-election as the only remaining Democratic statewide office holder in West Virginia, likely running against either GOP U.S. Representative Alex Mooney or Governor Jim Justice, both loyal Trump supporters. Since his decision not to run for re-election next week, political pundits have speculated that Manchin might be eyeing a potential presidential run as a candidate with no labels. Manchin has long been friendly with no labels, which has already begun holding private conversations with potential presidential nominees, Manchin among them. A group pushing for Manchin to partner with retiring Utah Senator Mitt Romney to seek a third-party presidential bid independently filed paperwork to form a formal draft committee with the Federal Election Commission on the same day Manchin announced he wouldn't vie to return to the Senate. Manchin said he has yet to make any decision about his next steps, but repeated his vow to travel the country to gauge interest in a centrist political movement. And now turning to local obituaries for Fort Dodge, first we remember Nancy Perkins. Services for Nancy will be held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, November 25th at historic Bruce Funeral Home. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to service. Next, we remember Florence Brown. Florence Brown, age 76, of Fort Dodge, died Wednesday, November 15th at Trinity Regional Medical Center. Funeral services are with Laufer-Swiler Funeral Home. And that's all the information we have on Florence at the moment. Next, we remember Kurt D. Kester. Kurt D. Kester, age 61, from Urbandale, peacefully passed away on November 12th. Family and friends are invited to pay their respects during the visitation on Thursday, November 16th, at Caldwell Parish Funeral Home from 4 to 7 p.m. A mass of Christian burial will be 10 a.m. Friday, November 17th, at St. Francis of Assisi Catholic Church in West Des Moines. Following the service, a lunch will be hosted in the parish hall. The interment will be a private family ceremony. Next, we remember LaDonna Rugg. Sister LaDonna will be held on Tuesday, November 21st at 11:30 a.m. at historic Bruce Funeral Home in Fort Dodge. Visitation will begin at 10 a.m. Next, we remember Francis Nutter. A mass of a Christian burial will be at 11 a.m. Tuesday at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Lake City. A rosary will be at 9:30 a.m. with visitation from 9:30 a.m. to 11 a.m. Burial will be in the St. Mary's Cemetery in Lake City. Next, we remember Clayton Corey. Funeral services for Clayton will be at 10:30 a.m. Monday at the Union Church in Lake City. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Sunday at the Lampy and Powers Funeral Home. Military rites will be accorded in the Lake City Cemetery. And now turning to local sports. This headline reads, Garrigan goes for gold. Golden Bears square off with Bedford in eight-player title round. The dateline is Cedar Falls. 7 years ago, Tate Forsh sat inside the UNI Dome and watched as the Bishop Garrigan football team fell in state finals to Gladbrook Rhinebeck. Now, Forsch and his teammates get their own shot at glory when they face Bedford here Thursday morning at 9:30 a.m. in the eight-player championship. "It still hasn't set in with me," Forsch said of playing for the title. "I still remember being a third grader and watching the 2016 team go to the state championship game. They unfortunately were not able to come home with a win, but that experience as a young kid was awesome. It was almost a chance to avenge the loss to Gladbrook Rhinebeck for the Golden Bears, who are 11-1 overall. But Bedford, who's 12-0, kicked a field goal late in the fourth to cap a rally and knock the Rebels off. Bishop Garrigan advanced with a commanding 34-20 victory over previously unbeaten and top-ranked Winfield Mount Union. The Bulldogs will be the fourth consecutive unbeaten team standing in front of Bishop Garrigan as they look to score a second state title to go along with the one they captured in 1985. They have already knocked off defending state champion Remsen St. Mary's and 2022 titleist Anita Cam. "Your dream of moments like this, and we are prepared," Forsch said. "We know it's not going to be easy, but we are going to try and be as prepared as we can be." Senior Caden Rothler ran for 181 yards and 4 touchdowns to lead the way for the Golden Bears versus Winfield Mount Union. Forsch, a sophomore, added 105 yards and a touchdown to senior Drew Lappy in the air, with 61 more yards rushing. The Garrigan defense held the Wolves, who had not scored under 34 points all year, out of the end zone for the duration of the second half, outgaining them 214-80. Bedford also needed a rally to advance, overcoming a 30-16 deficit in the fourth with 15 consecutive points. Garrison Motzinger rushed for 134 yards. Silas Walston added 83, and quarterback Connor Nally had 2 rushing touchdowns and a passing score to Graham Godsey. The Bulldogs were 5-4 last year and had won a total of 10 games over the past 3 seasons. The 11 wins this year are the most since the 2000 team went 10-2. And continuing with local sports for Fort Dodge, we have this headline, Iowa Central edged in 5-set thriller at Nationals, and the dateline is Cedar Rapids. The Iowa Central volleyball team dropped a tough 5-setter to Pensacola State here Wednesday at the NJCAA Division II Championships. Scores were 20-25, 25-21, 16-25, 26-24, and 15-12. The Tritons, who are 31-6 overall, will compete in the consolation second round back here on Thursday at 1 p.m., while Pensacola State, who's 32-2, advances to the quarterfinals at 5:30 p.m. It was quite the battle, ICC head coach Sarah Horn said. They came in with 31 wins and only 3 losses, so we knew they'd be really tough. We had opportunities to win in set 4 and again in set 5, but we just couldn't put it away in those tight moments. We made a couple of uncharacteristic mistakes in set 4, where we let 2 balls drop, and we typically don't do that. Credit to Pensacola for adding on to the pressure in addition to the pressure of the national tournament. Naomi Cicciaccio had 18 kills and 4 blocks to lead the way for Iowa Central. Emily Goodner and Emma Bilheimer each had 11 kills, with Olivia Sturgis adding 9. Mercedes Matlock dished out 42 assists, and Maya McLean 8. McLean also had 24 digs in the match, and Alexis Hracheta added 13. Sturgis also had 9 blocks, with Goodner adding 4, and Ariah Garrison 3. For Pensacola State, Annalise Rodriguez had 20 kills, and both Riley Carter and Cadence Godin added 9 each. Kiera Vega had 42 assists and 22 digs. Both fellow ICC-AC foes Des Moines Area and Kirkwood picked up victories in the opening rounds as the Bears knocked off Grand Rapids in 5 and the Eagles swept Heartland. And you're listening to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger and the Mason City Globe Gazette for Thursday, November 16th on IRIS, Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's news for Mason City. Our first headline today reads, Charles City voters deny $28.5 million school bond. It's back to the drawing board for the Charles City School District after voters denied a $28.5 million bond referendum proposed by the school board that would have seen the more than 50-year-old high school remodeled and expanded, in addition to constructing a new multi-purpose auditorium. Out of 2,478 total votes cast, 1,051, or 42.41%, were in favor of the measure, and 1,427, or 57.59%, voted against, defeating the proposal, according to the Iowa Secretary of State's office. The high school has undergone extensive repairs in recent years, and a new purpose-built auditorium has not been constructed in Charles City since 1931. The North Grand Auditorium was sold to private developers in 2021, leaving only gymnasiums as performance space for Charles City bands, orchestras, choirs, speech, and drama departments. Community members from the group Charles City Friends of the Performing Arts have been active since 2021 in fundraising efforts for a new first-class 800-seat state-of-the-art auditorium for school and community events. The majority of 600 locals who were surveyed by the district this summer indicated the most popular option was to keep the existing high school standing and adapt it for 21st century learning while adding an additional 800-seat multi-purpose auditorium space. In a statement released after the vote, Lundquist said, but it doesn't indicate who Lundquist is. At this time, we will not be able to move ahead on the revitalized plan, which called for a series of facility improvements at Charles City High School. This vote followed tremendous collaboration by our community, including 2 task forces, a community survey, and several community meetings. We are incredibly grateful for the input our community shared throughout this process. With this in mind, we know this result is not a reflection of the support of our community for our local schools. Rather, the solution presented simply was not the best fit at this time. After the Floyd and Chickasaw County election results are certified, the current board will adjourn, reconvening with two new members, Dara Jaeger and Bruce Koberick, and a new president, as incumbent Pat Rottinghouse came below the threshold for re-election. Of the 4,215 votes cast, Koberick received 660 votes, or 39.38%. Jaeger received 1,444 votes, or 34.26%. Rottinghouse received 1,085 votes, or 25.74%. There were 26 write-in votes. As a next step, Lundquist added, the Board of Education and District Administration will begin working on developing an alternative solution to the facility needs at the high school. We will ask for your continued engagement as we move ahead with this process. In the meantime, thank you for your consideration of the proposed bond measure on November 7th. The next regular meeting will be held November 27th at 6 p.m. That's 6:15 p.m. in the high school library. Our next headline reads, Latham sworn in as city councilman. Tim Latham took the oath of office during a ceremony at 2 p.m. Wednesday, November 15th at City Hall in the second floor conference room. The oath was administered by Mayor Bill Schickel. Latham was elected to the open at-large seat following the death of Tom Toma. Tom was a great guy, and I'm excited to get started with this great group of people. We all have similar goals for Mason City, he said. Nothing gets done quickly in state government, but we will start by building consensus. Incumbent council and park board members who were re-elected will take their new oath of office prior to their new term, which begins January 1st. These members are at-large councilman Paul Adams, first ward councilman John Lee, third ward councilman Joshua Mason, and park board members Jay Layla and Troy Levenhagen. If you have any questions, contact the city administrator's office at 641-421-2701. Our next local story reads, 2024 campaign, Governor Doug Burgum stumps in Mason City. North Dakota Governor and 2024 Republican presidential candidate Doug Burgum stopped in Mason City on Wednesday, taking his bid directly to potential caucus voters after failing to meet the polling threshold for the last two nationally televised presidential debates. A late October Des Moines Register NBC's Mediacom Iowa poll shows Burgum is polling from 19% to 23% in Iowa, with former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley running even with Florida Governor Ron DeSantis for a distant second place behind former President Donald Trump, among likely Iowa Republican caucus goers. Trump leads in every Iowa poll. Burgum used a scooter to meet and greet voters at the sports page at Southbridge Mall due to an Achilles tendon injury sustained in a pickup basketball game ahead of the first presidential debate, August 23rd. When asked if he could name two or three positions where he differs from the current administration, Burgum mentioned the economy, energy, and national security. We're going the wrong way on the economy, with high interest rates, inflationary spending, debt skyrocketing, and interest rates that are pushing the American dream of home ownership out of everyone's reach, he said. Burgum said the inflationary spending measures are, quote, crushing Iowa farmers as well, with high prices for diesel and fertilizer, which drives up the price of food. On energy policy, he said the Biden administration is headed in a 180-degree wrong direction. We're empowering foreign dictators. We're lifting oil sanctions on Iran and Venezuela, who are funding our enemies. Our oil sanctions on Russia are like Swiss cheese, and they've become China's discount gas station, he said. It's a battle, Burgum said. Liquid fuels are key to Iowa. Liquid fuel is Team USA. Biden is about Team EV, or electric vehicle, and that's China, because they control the rare minerals to make batteries. If you want to make electric vehicles, you're going to be sourcing those batteries from the world's largest polluter. Tying all these issues to national security, Burgum noted, we can't win a Cold War with China while we're in a proxy war with Russia and Iran. We can't compete and win in those if we don't have a strong economy. And we can't have a strong economy if we don't fix our energy policy. Jane Bloomingdale of Northwood represents the 60th District in the Iowa House of Representatives and recently endorsed Haley, but was in attendance to let the governor know she appreciated his stopping by. Any chance to listen to a presidential candidate is a good opportunity to learn, Bloomingdale said. Burgum has served as governor of North Dakota since 2016, a position he won with no prior political experience, but a background in business. He mortgaged his family's farmland to invest in Great Plains Software, which he sold to Microsoft for $1.1 billion in 2001. I learned as a kid that this country, while not perfect, is exceptional, said Burgum. I have created more jobs than everybody on that debate stage combined. I have written on the front of a paycheck since my mid-20s. Some of these people have only ever signed the back of one, Burgum quipped. Eric Weber is a Doug Burgum supporter and a member of the Story County Republican Central Committee. He is supporting Burgum in the Iowa caucus. I think he is the best candidate for Iowa and the best candidate for winning the election, because we need to bring in independents, said Weber. Despite the long odds, Weber feels optimistic that a strong showing in Iowa from Burgum could propel him to the nomination, admitting, getting more grassroots support in Iowa, I feel farmers from the rural part of the state would consider supporting Burgum because he's got agricultural experience as well as being a software entrepreneur. He's also very knowledgeable about the oil industry, all skills that we require in a president. Burgum agreed, saying he absolutely supports Iowa's first-in-the-nation caucuses and has been vocal about his disappointment of the Republican National Committee's debate criteria that has excluded him from the last two sanctioned debates, saying that every Iowa Republican caucus-goer, past, present, or future, ought to be offended that the RNC is trying to take away their job of narrowing the field. The path forward, said Burgum, we're going to keep doing what we're doing. We're the least well-known candidate, but the most well-liked. And the more people we talk to, we're converting caucus scores everywhere we go. The Republican presidential caucuses will be held on January 15th. Our next local headline reads, Families to Receive Thanksgiving Dinners from NICAO. North Iowa Community Action Organization will provide a Thanksgiving feast for a number of its client families. Staff members at the North Iowa Community Action Organization's Family Resource Center were surprised when area resident John Christensen delivered 300 pounds of fresh Kittleson Farms potatoes and 100 pounds of onions. The gesture kicked off a scramble to determine how best to use the gift for families who may not have the means to enjoy the holiday in traditional style. Workers searched contacts in their phones and reached out to businesses who have supported their client families in the past. Smithfield Foods donated 25 hams, and Hy-Vee stepped up with 60 packages of dinner rolls. Christensen's co-worker, Pearly Holloway, donated 3 turkeys. Fairway gave 60 cans of corn, and Walmart donated a $150 gift card to add to the boxes. Pinecrest School in Mason City presented the staff with pie crusts and fillings. I think it's really cool how one man's act of generosity started a chain reaction, said Mitchell Kieran, Director of Public Relations, Resource Development. Staff will pack boxes Friday morning for the lucky families. We would love to see an individual or a business step up and fill out these boxes for our families, said Melissa Nelson, Community Service Director. Things like canned vegetables or boxed desserts would be helpful. Gravy, stuffing, or other things to make the meal feel like a feast. Staff are expecting to pack 30 or more boxes and are accepting donations at the Family Resource Center, located at 100 First Street Northwest, Suite 140 in Mason City. Call 641-423-7766 with questions. Our next story has a headline that reads, Bandy's Miles, a 24-hour run will raise funds for YMCA on November 16th through the 17th. Ultra runner Mandy Prawl has a long history of supporting Mason City's YMCA. She now sits as board president, but her journey started not long after her birth. When Prawl was only 1 month old, her uncle drowned in Clear Lake. Her parents never wanted to experience that heartbreak again and made certain their children knew how to swim. As soon as they were able, they signed Mandy and her brother up for not just swim lessons, but nearly every program they could. Growing up utilizing Mason City's YMCA was ideal for the athletic and outgoing Prawl. She swam laps, shot hoops, and trained for long-distance races as the years passed. Now she's working to raise funds for the YMCA that has meant so much to her family and her development. "We are at a milestone moment for the Mason City Family YMCA," Prawl said. "The 23-year partnership with Mercy One has been critical to purchasing and maintaining the YMCA facilities. In 6 months, the second to the last mortgage payment is due. In 18 months, the final payment. Mercy One notified the YMCA board of their intent to leave the partnership at the final payment. Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center partnered with Mason City Family YMCA nearly 25 years ago to construct the new building and operate the YMCA as a fitness and rehabilitation center. As that partnership draws to a close, the board and staff are seeking new ways of sustaining the institution. The YMCA will be open to the public 24 hours over November 16th and 17th, with access to all facilities except the pool, so supporters can cheer Prawl on. After 9 p.m., admittance will be restricted to adults only. Donors have stepped up in creative ways for this fundraiser. Herzl said they reached out to businesses for donations, and some individuals are donating dollars per mile. At 2 p.m., the Newman Catholic High School girls basketball team will join Prawl on the track for a 3-mile run. "It's been a lot of fun seeing how people donate," said Prawl. "Some are donating by the mile. Some are guessing how many I'll actually log, and some are just dropping off a check," she said. Prawl's experience in long-distance running means she has a plan in place for her lengthy run. "I'll bank as many miles as I can early on. Ultra running is a mix of running and walking, so I have that. Plus, so many people have signed up just to be supportive while I'm on the track," she said. Prawl's goal is to log 100 miles, with each mile made up of 10.1 laps on the outer lane of the elevated track. Prawl will have to make more than 1,000 trips around the YMCA to meet her goal. "We're looking to raise $75,000 in this event, so I have to go big," said Prawl. Herzl encourages those who haven't visited the Y in a while to stop in during the fundraiser. "Come by and see what we're doing. Check out the facilities. We're making changes and hoping to create a fitness destination for the area," she said. The day's events will include poker runs, pickleball, and other activities. Donations are being accepted in person and online at masoncityymca.org. And now turning to today's obituaries for Mason City, we remember Joseph James DeMarco. Joseph James DeMarco, lovingly known as Joe, passed away peacefully in Bozeman, Montana on Friday, November 10th. He was 80 years old. The family will receive friends and family at Doakin Nelson Funeral Home service on Thursday, November 16th from 2 to 5 p.m. Rather than offering flowers, a donation to a charity that you care about would be a fitting tribute to Joe. Next, we remember Thomas Waldschmidt. Thomas E. Waldschmidt, age 69, of Mason City, died Saturday, November 11th at his home. A memorial mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, November 18th at Epiphany Parish Holy Family. Officiating will be the Reverend Neil Matternack. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. at Fullerton Funeral Home. A parish wake will be held at 5 p.m. And now turning to Dear Abby. Dear Abby responds to two letters today. The first one has a headline that reads, "Man strives to put mother's lies behind him." They write, "Dear Abby, I was born 40 years ago and raised by my mother to believe that her husband was my birth father. She divorced him and raised me while receiving court-awarded child support, based on her insistence to all involved that she had not had an affair. As the years went on, it became increasingly evident this wasn't true. So I took a genetic test. The result came back with a 99% likelihood that I had a different father. I soon made contact with the brother of the man I believed to be my birth father. He had personal knowledge of the affair and did a confirmational genetic test to show his genetic relationship to me. My mother continues to insist on what is now certainly a lie, perhaps to save face with me and others, and to avoid perjury charges and support repayments that might follow. I have not made contact with her for many years and changed my last name to my biological father's. He was a loving father figure to me in secret and is now deceased. My problem is I cannot find closure for all of my mother's countless lies and denials. She gaslighted me into feeling I was deranged while she cultivated a popular public face as a reporter and patron of the arts in our small town. I want to be able to reconcile with my past so I can be a better father to my own kids and be able to trust my loved ones fully. I feel weak as a person, and I don't want to pass that on to my kids. Please advise." And it's signed True Self in Canada. And Abby replies, "Dear True Self, you are not a weak man. You are an intelligent person who has been fed a pack of lies for decades, yet you managed to get close to the truth in spite of that. Your mother has lied because she is afraid she will lose standing in the community, and she is probably right about that. It would benefit you to discuss your family history with a licensed mental health professional. If you do, it will help to sort all this out more quickly than if you try to work through it on your own." And Abby's second letter today has a headline that reads, "Family wrestles with desire to relocate." They write, "Dear Abby, I am torn between my and my husband's desire to move and my obligation to my family. We decided to explore moving out of state because of the climate. Where we currently live is very dry and hot in the summer, and wildfires often cause smoky skies for weeks. We can hardly go outside in the summer. My widowed mother lives close by and knows how much we struggle in the summer, but she's in her 60s and healthy. She doesn't need to be taken care of yet. Now that we've chosen a place to move a few states away, she has convinced my grandmother, who lives out of state and recently went into independent living, to move close to all of us. I'm torn between moving somewhere I feel my quality of life would improve and staying close to my grandmother, who I have never lived near before. How do I make this decision?" It's signed, "Making a Decision in Colorado." And Abby responds, "Dear Making a Decision, decide rationally. If you opt to make the move, which would be understandable, discuss it with your mother. Although her health is strong now, she and your grandmother may be open to the idea of relocating to your new city so you can all be together." And now turning to Mason City area sports, we have this headline that reads, "High School Cross Country, the 2023 Globe Gazette All Area Boys Team." The North Iowa boys cross country races were a treat to watch this season. both the individual and team races. Here is the 2023 Globe Gazette All-Area Boys Team. Runner of the year is senior Justin Rye from Lake Mills. Rye is the repeat runner of the year after finishing sixth in the Class 1A state meet with a personal best and school record time of 16 minutes 14 seconds and leading the Bulldogs to their first state championship as a team. He won four races, including the top Iowa Conference meet at NIACC with a time of 17 minutes 21 seconds. And here's the all-area team. First is Zach Flatebow, a junior at Garner Hayfield Ventura. Flatebow made the state meet a season ago, but shot up the boards this season and finished 13th in the 2A meet this season at 16 minutes 35 seconds. He ran a personal best of 16 minutes 08 seconds in the state qualifying meet to finish second and lead the team qualifying Cardinals. Next is Silas Gann, a sophomore from Forest City. Gann paced a young and solid Indian squad. I'm sorry, I clicked on a link there and got some audio. So let's begin again. Silas Gann is a sophomore from Forest City. Gann placed a young and solid Indian squad this fall. He ran a personal best of 16 minutes 58 seconds in the state qualifying meet to finish in seventh place and to help the team qualify. Gann appeared in the 2A individual rankings for most of the season and finished in the top 10 eight times. Next is senior Connor Hammett from Garner Hayfield Ventura. Hammett came into the season with high expectations and rebounded from a slow start to return to strong form. He ran a personal best at 16 minutes 50 seconds to finish sixth in the 2A state qualifier and helped the Cardinals qualify as a team. Hammett had eight top 10 finishes. Next is sophomore Newt Rogney from Lake Mills. Rogney was stellar in his role this fall, finishing in the top six in 11 of his 12 races. He finished 27th in the 1A state meet at 17 minutes 3.03 seconds for the champions. He ran a personal best of 16 minutes 47 seconds in the Forest City Invitational to finish fourth. Next is Mason City senior Rashawn Sinwell. Sinwell missed the state qualifying race, but was in line to earn a berth in the Class 4A meet. He ran a personal best of 16 minutes 27 seconds in the Iowa Alliance Conference meet at Mason City High School. He also finished third in a good field with 16 minutes 47 in the Mason City Invitational. Next is Lake Mills junior Cade Van Rockel. Van Rockel teamed up with Rogney to be one of the best number 2 and 3 runner combos in the state this fall. He finished 24th in the state meet with a time of 17 minutes and also finished in the top 6 of 11 of 12 races. He ran a personal best of 16 minutes and 53 seconds in the Mason City Invitational. Next is Charles City Jr., Nick Williams. Williams, a two-time state qualifier, made a big jump from his sophomore to junior season. He finished 25th in the 3A meet with a time of 16 minutes and 39 seconds, a personal best. He also finished 5th in the state qualifier with 16 minutes and 49 seconds, and second in the Northeast Iowa Conference meet of 16 minutes 58 seconds. And in a similar article, here's the 2023 Globe Gazette All-Area Girls Team. The North Iowa girls cross-country scene was deep this season with talented runners with a good mix of veterans and underclassmen. Here's the 2023 Globe Gazette All-Area Girls Team. Runner of the year is Addie Duggan, a junior at Clear Lake. Duggan was one of the best runners in Class 3A this season and won her state qualifying meet with a time of 19 minutes and 7 seconds. She posted her season best time of 19 minutes 0.06 seconds at the Lions home meet at Veterans Memorial Golf Course on September 14th. Duggan has qualified for state in each of her 3 seasons. And here's the all-area team. Sophomore Scarlett Burns of Osage. Burns burst onto the scene as a freshman, and her sophomore year was even better. She won 2 meets this season, the Newman Catholic Invitational and the Hampton-Dumont Cal Invitational, and finished 10th in the 2A state meet with a time of 19 minutes 0.08 seconds. Next is sophomore Brogan Evans of Mason City. In her first season running cross country, too, Evans steadily improved over the season and qualified for the 4A state meet and finished 68th with a 19.47. Evans won the Mason City Invitational and finished second at the Algona Invitational with a season best of 19 minutes 0.41. Next is Clear Lake senior Anna Feuerbeck. Feuerbeck was one of the best runners in the area this year, despite being the number 2 for the Lions. She finished her career with 15th place finish in the 3A state meet with a personal best of 19 minutes 22 seconds. She finished in the top 5 of 3 different races, including a 3rd place finish in the state qualifier at 19 minutes 55 seconds. Next is sophomore Lila Powers from St. Ansgar. Powers was a Class 1A state qualifier this season after finishing 8th in the qualifying meet with a personal best of 20 minutes 22 seconds time. The sophomore finished in the top 10 in 9 of her 12 races and broke 20 minutes 7 times. Powers finished in the 32nd in the state meet with a time of 20 minutes 26 seconds. And next is freshman Carmen Sharp of Forest City. A successful middle school runner, Sharp was one of the most consistent runners in the area as a freshman. She posted a season best of 20 minutes 11 seconds to finish 29th in the 2A state meet and broke the 20-minute mark in 6 of her 12 meets. She also finished top 5 in 7 meets. Next is junior Bethany Warren of Forest City. Warren stole headlines all season for her success in both volleyball and cross country. A successful track athlete, Warren's first season running cross country was a success. She finished 14th in the 2A state meet with a personal record of 19 minutes 35 seconds and helped the Indians qualify as a team. And finally, sophomore Claire Zweibommer of Riceville. Zweibommer followed up a successful freshman season with an even better sophomore one. She finished 2nd in the 1A state qualifier at 20 minutes and 19th in the state meet at 20 minutes 02 seconds. Zweibommer posted her best time of the season in the Iowa Star Conference meet, finishing 2nd with 19 minutes and 48 seconds. And that concludes today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger and the Mason City Globe Gazette for Thursday, November 16th. I'm your reader, Mark John Conley. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening and have a great Thursday. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Shortly after modern humans arrived in Europe, the Neanderthals disappeared, and scientists think we had something to do with it. Neanderthals, or their direct ancestors, migrated out of Africa and into the Middle East and Europe around 250,000 years ago. Soon, they were well adapted to the environment. Large eyes helped them see in the longer nights and darker winters. Stout bodies helped them retain heat and handle large prey, and provided space for the large liver and kidneys needed for a diet heavy in protein. Their brains were as big as ours, but spent processing power on their greater visual and motor abilities. This may not have allowed them to develop higher communication or conceptual thinking to match ours, which may have been their downfall. Modern humans arrived on the scene 45,000 years ago, less physically adapted, but more mentally adaptable. We had cooperative hunting methods superior to the Neanderthals, allowing us to outcompete them for food, and perhaps reducing the large herbivore populations that they depended on. We also had superior tools and weapons. When there were conflicts between the groups, as there have been among tribes throughout history, our superior technology probably allowed us to prevail. But we weren't only fighting. There must have been considerable interbreeding, since we can find 1-3% of the Neanderthal genome in modern man. Which means the Neanderthals never completely disappeared. A little bit of them is alive in us today. I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.